We left off at Micah 7, verses 11 and 12 last time, and it read, "That will be the day for rebuilding your walls, a day for expanding your territory, a day when your people will come back to you from Asher, from the cities of Egypt, from Egypt and as far as from the Euphrates River, from sea to sea and from mountain to mountain." Now, in these two verses, we hear this reverberation of a sarcastic, mocking question asked by Israel's enemies, who up to now had become most successful in oppressing them. And this question appears in the middle of verse 10, where it says, "Where is Yahweh your God?" So the sneers and jeers of Israel's unbelieving enemies are about to be silenced when a complete reversal of fortunes happens, that they learn the hard way of just who Yahweh is. And it comes upon them on that day when it finally arrives, but assuredly it is going to arrive. Now, because that day or the day is always eschatological in time frame, whenever it appears in the Bible, that is, it's in the end times future, then we can take it to mean that here. It hasn't happened yet. But all the signs of that day approaching or having have just entered into it are present now on earth. It's in alignment with prophets as well as Yeshua have told us to watch for. Now, while this ought to stir up great excitement among all God worshipers, at the same time, we need to be sober about how this is going to play out. And it's not going to be pretty. The terrible things that happen worldwide are described in various places in both the Old and New Testaments as having no historical equivalent. Just the awesomeness of heaven is beyond our minds to comprehend. So will be the horror of all but the climaxing moments of the end times. But as Micah is speaking now of Israel's vindication and restoration, then it is the good and lovely things of the end that are being described at the moment. Now, I want to review for just a couple of minutes the final subject of our previous lesson. In order to do that, I need to use a couple of different Bible versions to make my point. The YLT, that's the Young's Literal Translation, says in verse 11, "The day to build thy walls, that day removed is the limit." In the King James Version, "In the day that thy walls are to be rebuilt, in that day shall the decree be far removed." The issue is near the end of this verse where the complete Jewish Bible says, "A day for expanding your territory." The YLT says, "Removed is the limit." The King James Version says, "Shall the decree be far removed?" See, the word that all these verses are struggling with is hulk, hulk. Hulk has the scope of meaning to include limit, boundary, decree, even something that's owed. The only way to properly interpret this is to abandon both the popular Christian and Jewish doctrine and instead look to the historical era and the context in which we find this word used. Christian scholars and Bible teachers nearly unanimously ascribe the meaning as the decree is abolished, and that decree is either the words of the prophet and the Torah as regards Israel in general, or the law of Moses in specific. That is, Israel's glorious future is abandoned by Yahweh in favor of him giving that glory and future to the Gentile church. Jewish scholars tend to see this as the long-promised entry into the new golden era for Israel, and so all limits and curses against them are being canceled by God. What we can say for certain is that God is going to do a new thing in the end times that goes beyond the spectacular and the unprecedented. Israel will be the center of it. It'll be joyous for Israel, the opposite for the nations of the world. The church also says that this return and restoration refer to a single person, the He of verse 12, except that the word He is incorrect. And only Bibles like the King James Version use it. All other versions do not modify the grammar to suit them. They use the word they. So this is a group of people, not a single person. Of course, in Christendom, their bent is to say that the He is about Jesus. Certainly the return of Yeshua is involved in the climactic events of the end times, but that's not the point of verse 11. Verse 12 then speaks of the they being the hordes of people coming from every direction back to the holy city of Jerusalem. The they in this context are the dispersed Israelites. Why say Jerusalem and not Judah or Israel or the Holy Land in general? It is that when the phrase rebuilding your walls is used, it is referring to Jerusalem, then using that reference figuratively as a way to represent all the Holy Land. The term your walls is also being used figuratively of Jerusalem and of the Holy Land in general and of the Israelites as a whole. It's not unlike in our modern world making, say, London to be representative of England as a whole, or figuratively as the British people as a whole, because London is the seat of their government, and a government is representative of a nation and its people. It's not meant to be mysterious. It's only a common way of speaking that was well understood in the era it was written. Now, in the end, regardless of nuances and details, here we see the establishment of Israel as it was always meant to be by God. But due to the unfaithfulness of the people, it had never been achieved. This is the ideal Israel, the holy place where God dwells and rules, the place that is a bright beacon of truth, sitting on a hill with a light that draws all the people of the world to it. The place where the purest truth and righteousness goes forth. It's coming and it's near. Let's read the remainder of Micah chapter 7. We're going to start at verse 13 and go to the end. The earth will be desolate for those living in it as a result of their deeds. Shepherd your people with your staff, the flock that belongs to you, who live alone like a forest in the middle of a fertile pasture. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead as they did in days of old. As in the days when you came out of Egypt, I will show them wonders. The nations will see and be put to shame in spite of all their power. They will cover their mouths with their hands. Their ears will be deafened. They will lick the dust like snakes. They will emerge from their fortresses, trembling like reptiles that crawl around on the earth. They will come with fear to Adonai, our God, afraid because of you. Who is a God like you, pardoning the sin and overlooking the crimes of the remnant of his heritage. He does not retain his anger forever, but he delights in grace. He will again have compassion on us. He will subdue our iniquities. You will throw all their sins into the depths of the sea. You will show truth to Jacob, to Jacob, and grace to Abraham, as you have sworn to our ancestors since days of long ago. Verse 13 is what some callers call transitional. Up to now, Micah has been speaking of a wonderful future for Israel that abruptly stops. That is, verse 13 reverts to desolation. After that, verse 14 picks back up the theme of redemption, restoration, and blessing. Now, the first words of this verse present an instant division of thought and meaning. The division concerns the scope of its effects. It starts with "and the land." The Hebrew used is "eretz," which can mean both land and earth. So is this referring to the land of Israel, or is this referring to planet Earth in general? Is this meaning that for Israel, one condition will be occurring, but an opposite one for the rest of the earth? Or does it mean this is speaking only of the Holy Land and the Israelites? Now, while the popular theology is that it means the entire earth, this seems to defy the context of this chapter that's all about Israel. In fact, very likely, the best English words to use to begin this chapter ought to be "but the land," not "and the land," or "and the earth." The word "but," meaning "however" or "nevertheless," which some Bible versions do include. So the flow of the text is that before this wonderful future for Israel can be apprehended, as we've just been reading about, there will be a time of devastation and desolation for the land of Israel. Why? Just remember, it's a reminder from God that sin demands justice. God's promised future restoration doesn't invalidate God's promises of punishment. There is no change of mind occurring. I will acknowledge that as some Christian scholars see this as meaning that while Israel is being vindicated and restored, the rest of the world has suffered desolation and destruction, this can't be completely discounted. In fact, it could very well be something that proves true both ways at the same time. Israel has to suffer desolation as proper justice for their sins before their restoration can begin. And while Israel is being restored, the remainder of the planet Earth is undergoing destruction because the nations had come to invade Jerusalem and the Holy Land. I suppose this will simply have to be placed into the category of wait and see. Now, Micah 7:14 says this: "Shepherd your people with your staff, the flock that belongs to you who live alone like a forest in the middle of a fertile pasture. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead as they did in days of old." We also need to look at this verse in a more literal rendering. So in the YLT it says, "Rule thou thy people with thy rod, the flock of thine inheritance, dwelling alone in a forest in the midst of Carmel. They enjoy Bashan and Gilead as in days of old." Okay. So now that we have moved past that transitional role of verse 13, we get back into the flow of restoration for Israel. What we are reading here mostly resembles a poetic prayer. Micah is more or less committed, restored Israel into God's care. He speaks of God in his role as the great shepherd, so the people are depicted as his flock. There is some ambiguity over the nature of God's rule in that it speaks of how he shall rule as using his shevet. Various versions generally choose between interpreting this word as either rod or staff. Shevet has such a wide range of meaning that it can mean either of those things, or even mean a club or a scepter. The conundrum is that while God is depicted as the great shepherd, then one would think the meaning of shevet is staff, as in a shepherd's crook. However, because the concept of ruling over the people is in the sense of the opening words, it carries a notion of meting out strict justice, like a judge. So then the word rod better fits, because the sense of a rod is as the authority to judge. Now, I lean towards this being a shepherd's crook because of the opening word of the verse, which in Hebrew is ra'ah. Ra'ah means to pasture, feed, graze, tend. But it can also mean to be a friend. So while the word shepherd isn't there, the role and characteristics of a shepherd is. This word is a gentle word. It's not harsh. So I think we probably ought to think of a shepherd lovingly tending over his flock with his shepherd's crook, caring for them, as opposed to being a strict ruler or a judge. So with that tone in mind, then the second half of the verse entails the extent of the pasture. That is, the extent of the pasture land is being spoken about. And the tonal shift is noticeable and important because it has gone from God vigorously confronting Israel and threatening them to comforting them and becoming a gentle father. Now, the locations are then spoken of as where this pasture will be. Now, Carmel is on the eastern side of the mountain range from modern-day Haifa. Haifa is a coastal port city that is more or less in central Israel. Gilead is on the east side of the Jordan River, where modern-day Jordan exists. Bashan is further to the north, where the Golan Heights in southern Syria exist today. So all three of these areas are representative of fertile regions, good for pasturing sheep, for growing crops and orchards. Here, it also stands for the entire land, the extent of the good land God has given to Israel to inhabit. Now, the mention of Israel dwelling alone jumps out. Clearly, unlike our times, when enemies live within the state of Israel, Muslims primarily, but also some anti-Israel Christians, that constantly cause Israelis trouble, this will no longer be the case. The other nations will finally accept and respect Israel's borders and sovereignty and faith, and that this land was set aside for the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and no one else. This doesn't mean that other ethnic groups might not live there, but if they do, it is because they are welcome and they are considered as true citizens of Israel who worship the God of Israel in truth. Now, as this verse ends, we hear that in ancient times, relative to Micah, all these places were safe and relatively peaceful. The era this can only be referring to is when Israel was a united kingdom under David, then Solomon. If we go back five more centuries or so to Moses than Joshua, that was not the case, because those areas were notoriously troublesome for Israel. What Israel was experiencing in Micah's day was the opposite of this. Jeremiah underlines the gist of what we're reading here in Micah, in Jeremiah 50, starting at verse 17. Israel is a stray lamb that was driven away by lions. First to devour him was Asher's king. The last to break his bones is this Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel. Therefore, Yehovah Zevaot, the God of Israel, says, I will punish the king of Babel and his lands as I punished the king of Asher. I'll bring Israel back to his pasture, to graze on the Carmel and the Bashan, on the hills of Ephraim and in Gilead, till he has his fill. In those days at that time, says Yehovah, Israel's guilt will be sought, but there will be none. And Judah's sins, they won't be found, for I will pardon the remnant that I leave. So, while the Christian church has decided that we can just cross out Israel and Judah in the prophets and substitute church, that is decidedly a serious doctrinal error. In truth, to call it an error is much too lenient, as this implies accidental. This doctrine merely reflects the church's intention to make Christianity a purely Gentiles-only religion that has granted all the blessings and promises God gave originally to Israel. This doctrine can make gobbledygook out of the Old Testament and prophets with this agenda-driven belief. It doesn't matter, because the truth is here for all to see. Micah 7:14 calls Israel the flock of thine inheritance, that leaves all other nations and all other faiths out. Micah 7:15, as in the days when you came out of Egypt, I will show them wonders. Verse 15 is God's reply to Micah's poetic prayer of verse 14. The returning remnant from all the nations will experience miracles like their ancestors did as Moses led them out of bondage in Egypt. God guarantees that he'll be there to aid Israel and to see to it that what he has ordained will come to pass. And as I've mentioned before, the miracle of the return of the 10 lost tribes is well underway, and we are witnesses to it, if we care to be. Micah 7:15 is happening. Although we can be sure that even greater, more powerful miracles are yet to come to turn this trickle of returnees to a flood. It is only by God's wonders that this is happening. Till the first 2 years of the 21st century, Israel did not want this return. Okay? They saw these tribes of people that identified by the various names of the 10 tribes of Israel as fraudsters, even as a threat. This is because to most Jews, what really makes a Jew, is practicing cultural Judaism, something most of those tribes didn't do. It was also and remains a common refrain, it's a tradition, that the Jewish people represent all that remains of all the tribes of Israel, even though historically and in every other rational way, the Jews represent only the tribes of Benjamin and Judah. What is also miraculous is that the modern state of Israel finally officially granted the members of these scattered, non-Jewish Israelite tribes the right to come home without first having to convert to Judaism, although many did and continue to. These wonders, however, do not stop with the return of the people. but also with all that goes with it. And how could the powerful Egyptians be defeated and let God's people go? It will happen for the constantly harassed Israel in our time, in the same way it happened in Egypt. Micah says in chapter 5 that God will actually take away the Israelis' powerful military weapons when their battle with the nations starts in earnest. In Egypt, the Hebrews never fought the Egyptians in order to leave. God did it all. In the end times return of Israel to their land and to world stature, God will decimate the nations that comes to fight with Israel. But victory won't be because of Israel's military prowess. Just as God did it via 10 miraculous plagues in Egypt, he will do it in equally as wondrous ways when the war of Armageddon begins. So this is literal. It's not hyperbole. Verses 16 and 17 are a couplet. They need to be read together. The nations will see and be put to shame in spite of all their power. They will cover their mouths with their hands. Their ears will be deafened. They'll lick the dust like snakes. They will emerge from their fortresses trembling like reptiles that crawl about on the earth. They will come to fear, Jehovah our God, afraid because of you. Now, the first few words of verse 16 are something we've seen before in regards to Israel and modern times as well as in antiquity. I think it's important that we see it, we notice it, and interpret those things about Israel that are now in the recent past in these same terms. What Israel has been able to do to their enemies is astounding. It makes no rational sense at all. First, within 24 hours of Israel being given recognition by a vote of the UN as a new and sovereign Jewish nation on May 14, 1948, a coalition of 5 Arab League armies attacked Israel with their well-armed militaries. Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Jordan, with tanks, modern air forces, thousands of trained soldiers, they fell upon Israel. Israel had none of these kinds of forces or weapons. They had no air force or tanks. They had no national military. They were a weakly armed bunch of Jews with a few militia groups that didn't even trust one another, each having their own differing political views. And yet, somehow, Israel won and chased those 5 armies out of their newly declared country, tails between their legs. The Arab nations plus Egypt were humiliated, put to shame with a sting that was only the first of other stings to come. Those stings are vivid to their minds to this day. Israel's victory made no rational sense. They were outmanned 7-1, completely outgunned. Still, they achieved victory. The Lord fought for his people, just as he promised he would, so the outcome was determined before the first bullet was fired in anger. 1967, the Israeli government learned through their intelligence apparatus of a pending surprise attack by Jordan, Syria, and Egypt. Well, Israel by now did have a standing army, had acquired some modern military weapons, but still, in comparison to those 3 nations' powerful and large militaries, it would seem like no contest. So rather than wait to be attacked, Israel took the initiative and launched a preemptive strike against those determined nations. Not only did Israel win overwhelmingly and were able to defend their own nation, but they also captured from these enemies the Golan Heights of Syria and the Gaza Strip, the so-called West Bank that was of Jordan, the entire Sinai Peninsula that belonged to Egypt. This was an incredible humiliation for those nations, even worse than in 1948, that greatly shamed not only themselves, but also the religion of Islam worldwide. Only God could do such a thing, which he did just as promised. In 1973, those two of those shamed nations, Syria and Egypt, worked together and launched a surprise attack on Israel on the high holy day of Yom Kippur. Israel had become complacent, was caught totally unprepared. These two nations that had lost huge chunks of their national territory to Israel were determined to reverse that humiliation. In the first few hours of battle, Israel was literally overrun. But somehow, they reversed the situation and won. It ended really closer to a stalemate. But the Arab nations cheered, as with the first 72 hours, it looked like a total Arab victory and an Israeli slaughter. Many miraculous stories came out of that war. I personally know a decorated IDF colonel who had one of the most amazing experiences of them all. He was shot, lying critically wounded near the Syrian border when he was run over by one of his own military's tanks. He lay helpless, crushed, and broken, near death, in a field. He heard Arab voices from the Syrian army approaching all around him. Suddenly, an impossible-to-bear bright light lit up the night sky. And a voice from the sky told this man he would not die, but instead he would be God's messenger to take an oracle to the world, that one day the temple in Jerusalem would become a house of prayer for all nations. The sound of Arab voices just suddenly went silent. He eventually was rescued, spent the next year in the hospital having his body literally reconstructed. A few years later, this man met a couple of the former Syrian soldiers that had defected to Israel, who had been at that very place at that same moment. He was so wounded and injured and bleeding out. And he asked them why and their comrades so suddenly left. They said that their platoon of men was working their way through the field of tall grasses looking for wounded soldiers from both sides, when suddenly this huge light appeared in the form of a gigantic flaming angel. It stood before them, blocking their path. The angel said not a word, but it so terrified every last member of his platoon, they ran with all their might back to where their main forces were. They had no explanation for this, but they were adamant this happened to them. God saved Israel and this man in ways that are too incredible to be anything but a miracle. Folks, this is going to happen again, only in a wider scale and a larger scope than what is imaginable. Today, Israel is well-armed and ready, and the IDF is one of the most formidable militaries in the world. They will be even more powerful when someday, not long from now, the nations of the world will unite their forces to resolve the Israel problem once and for all. A huge multinational force will attack Israel. Israel will be reasonably confident that with their forces, their advanced armaments, and cunning strategies, they will win. But the prophet Micah tells us that in the most strange way, God will intervene. First, he will neutralize those advanced weapons Israel has as they're being attacked. Then he will soundly defeat that multinational force with his own miraculous power. Israel being a grateful but stunned nation. However, it is the opposite story for the Gentile nations of the world. They will see, meaning they will experience all of this. You know what? Probably on our TVs and smartphones, but some of it on the battlefield. Just assuming the outcome. Because of the enormous firepower the nations combined can wield. But as they watch, they will cover their mouths with shame. Or rather, cover their mouths with their hands, and their ears will be deafened. They will not believe what they are seeing and hearing because it's impossible to happen. They will be thoroughly confused. These, of course, are those who don't believe God's prophets. They will be the Islamic nations, completely secular nations like Europe, nations that profess God and Christ to some degree, like the USA, but refuse to accept God's Bible as having relevance for today. They will continue to believe that Israel may have been God's focal point and set apart people many centuries ago, but now that position has been removed from them, given to others. Islam believing it is them, Judeo-Christians leaning nations believing it's not Islam, it's the church. Never think or believe that this will be a war of atheists versus God's worshipers. This will far more likely be very much a battle of faiths of some nations, a battle for wealth for others, a battle for world dominance for the remainder of those who believe that stubborn Israel is the one thing that's holding the world back from having peace. Moving on to verse 17. The enemies of Israel will be licking the dust like a snake. See, this is an idiom for the humiliation of the defeated. It's interesting that in this verse, the term snake is preceded by the article the. So to better translate it in biblical vocabulary as the serpent. And we know biblically the serpent is identified with the adversary, or what Christians call Satan and the devil. Now, I have no doubt this narrative in Micah is meant to take us back to the third chapter of Genesis for a connection. Listen to Genesis 3:14. Yahweh God said to the serpent, "Because you have done this, you are cursed more than all livestock and animals. You will crawl on your belly and eat dust as long as you live." Next, verse 17 speaks of the leaders of these nations emerging from their bunkers, trembling with fear and confusion because of what's just happened. They'll fall on their faces in utter terror before Yahweh, because they will suddenly realize that these impossible things that have happened can be explained in no other way than the acts of a wrathful, long ago dismissed as a myth, God of the Bible. The God of Israel, the protector of Israel. God is a God of patterns. And the divine pattern has been repeated many times over. Just as the prophecies of this happening and then their fulfillments have been repeated many times over as the centuries come and go. Just in ever ascending scope, in widening extent. Verses 18 and 19 are also a couplet that needs to be read together, as it was with verses 16 and 17. So verses 18 and 19 read, "Who was a God like you, pardoning the sin and overlooking the crimes of the remnant of his heritage? He does not retain his anger forever because he delights in grace. He will again have compassion on us. He will subdue our iniquities. You will throw all their sins into the depths of the sea." So the character and nature of God that has been revealed since Genesis 1:1 is sort of summarized here as to why he has taken such actions against the nations and has favored and blessed Israel. This has to be Micah praising God for the redemption or restoration of Israel that was promised so very long ago. God's grace cannot be measured. See, it's interesting that this phrase, who is like you, who is a God like you, is essentially the same as Micah's name. That means, who is like Yahweh? See, this question that is also an expression of awe and praise is from very ancient times, well before Micah. In almost psalm-like tone, we read in Exodus 5, 11 through 13, who is like you, Yahweh, among the mighty? Who is like you, sublime in holiness, awesome in praises, working wonders? You reached out with your right hand, the earth swallowed them. In your love, you led the people you redeemed. In your strength, you guided them to your holy abode. See, this expression, while being essentially a praise, is also rather rhetorical, with the expected response by God's people, that is, no one. No one. That we have such a God that offers forgiveness of sins and a means to have those sins atoned for and set aside forever is because of his attribute of grace. And yet, Gentiles, please notice who this is offered to. It is offered to the remnant of his heritage, which is always biblically Israel, never the nations. While God's anger and wrath is real, it doesn't last forever, but his compassion and love do for his people. This is not a new thought. It is an end-to-end biblical type of thinking. Jeremiah 50, 19 through 20. I will bring Israel back to his pasture to graze on the Carmel and the Bashan and the hills of Ephraim and Gilead until he has his fill. In those days, at that time, says Yahweh, Israel's guilt will be sought. There'll be none. Judah's sins, but they won't be found. For I'll pardon the remnant I leave. For those who still cling to the false man-made doctrines of the Constantinian Church, where in this and so many other biblical passages do you find any mention of you partaking in this grace and compassion? God says he'll forgive Israel's guilt. He'll forget Judah's sins. How do you manage to erase those people and insert yourself into their place? First, such an erasure never occurred, and according to God, is virtually impossible. But second, God did make a way for Gentiles to join into the promises he made for Israel. I don't have the time to go into all this now. You can go on your own to the Torah class study on the book of Romans. Pay special attention to chapter 11. If it's easier for you to read in book form rather than online, then go to holylandmarketplace.com and purchase my book of commentary in Romans 9. It's the only place you can get it. But what Paul says in Romans explains so very much about the faith that Christ taught as over and against the popular doctrines taught by the church. Micah 7:20. You will show truth to Jacob, grace to Abraham, as you have sworn to our ancestors since days of long ago. The climactic words of Micah's book tells Israel and us that all those promises he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob will finally happen. I can do no better than to quote a favorite teacher and scholar of mine, Walter Kaiser Jr. He says this, the last three verses of this book are linked with the book of Jonah for the afternoon reading in the synagogue on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Once every year on Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, the Orthodox Jews go to a stream or a river and symbolically empties his sins from his pockets into the water as he recites Micah 7, 18 through 20. This is the Tashlich service, named after the Hebrew word for you will cast. It symbolizes that God can and will take our sins, wash them down the streams of running water, bury them deep into the depths of the ocean. God not only forgives our sins, if he is omniscient, let it be remembered that what he does when he forgets our sins is to remember them against us no more. These promises from God to do just this were always directed to his Israelite people and to all who would join with them. God's promises all bound up in his everlasting covenants with Israel, and which, somehow, a Gentile must be joined. How? Read the book of Romans. Psalms 105, 8 through 10. He remembers his covenant forever. The word he commanded to 1,000 generations. The covenant he made with Abraham, the oath he swore to Isaac and established as a law for Jacob, for Israel, an everlasting covenant. Okay, this concludes our study of the profound and deeply contemporary book of Micah. Okay?